Sure you do. I mean, it's pretty universal. Your heart seems to stop. Your mouth dries up. Your skin goes cold and goosebumps rise all over your body. Instead of meshing, the cogs in your head just spin. I almost scream. I really do. I think, it's the thing I don't want to look at. It's the thing in the window seat. Then I see the fan overhead, the blades turning at their slowest speed. I see a crack of early morning light running down the middle of the pulled drapes. I see the graying milkweed fluff of Ellen's hair on the other side of the bed. I'm here on the Upper East Side, fifth floor, and everything's okay. The dream was just a dream. As for what's under the bed, I toss back the covers and slide down to my knees like a man who means to pray. But instead of that, I lift the flounce and peer under the bed. I only see a dark shape at first. Then the shape's head turns, and two eyes gleam at me. It's Lady. She's not supposed to be under there, and I guess she knows it. Hard to tell what a dog knows and what it doesn't, but I must have left the door open when I came to bed. Or maybe it didn't quite latch and she pushed it open with her snout. She must have brought one of her toys with her from the basket in the hall. At least it wasn't the blue bone or the red rat. Those have squeakers in them, and would have wakened Ellen for sure. And Ellen needs her rest. She's been under the weather.
Lady, I whisper, come out of there.
She only looks at me. She's getting on in years and not so steady on her pins as she used to be, but she's not stupid. She's under Ellen's side, where I can't reach her. If I raise my voice, she'll have to come, but she knows, I'm pretty sure she knows, that I won't do that, because if I raise my voice, it will wake Ellen for sure. As if to prove this, Lady turns away from me, and the chewing recommences. Well, I can handle that. I've been living with Lady for 13 years, nearly half my married life. There are three things that get her on her feet. One is the rattle of her leash and a call of elevator. Another is the thump of her food dish on the floor. The third, I get up and walk down the short hall to the kitchen. From the cupboard, I take the bag of snack and slices, making sure to rattle it. I don't have to wait long for the muted clitter of cocker claws. 5 seconds, and she's right there. She doesn't even bother to bring her toy. I offer her one of the little carrot shapes, then toss it into the living room. A little mean, maybe, but the fat old thing can use the exercise. She chases her treat. I linger long enough to start the coffee maker, then go back into the bedroom. I'm careful to pull the door all the way shut. Ellen's still sleeping. And waking up before she does has one benefit. No need for the alarm. I turn it off. Let her sleep a little later. It's a bronchial infection. I was scared for a while there, but now she's on the mend. I go into the bathroom and officially christen the day by brushing my teeth. I've read that in the morning a person's mouth is as germicidally dead as it ever gets, but the habits we learn as children are hard to break. I turn on the shower, get it good and hot, and step in. The shower's where I do my best thinking, and this morning I think about the dream. 5 nights in a row I've had it, but who's counting, right? Nothing really awful happens in this dream, but in a way that's the worst part, because I know, absolutely, positively, that something awful will happen, if I let it. I'm in an airplane, in business class. I'm in an aisle seat, which is where I prefer to be, so I don't have to squeeze past anybody if I have to go to the toilet. My tray table is down. On it are a bag of peanuts and an orange drink that looks like a vodka sunrise, a drink I've never ordered in real life. The ride is smooth. If there are clouds, we're above them. The cabin is filled with sunlight. Someone is sitting in the window seat, and I know if I look at him, or her, or possibly it, I'll see something that will turn my bad dream into a nightmare. If I look into the face of my seatmate, I may lose my mind. It could crack open like an egg, and a tide of bloody darkness might pour out. I give my soapy hair a quick rinse, step out, dry off. My clothes are folded on a chair in the bedroom. I take them and my shoes into the kitchen, which is now filling with the smell of coffee. Nice. Lady's curled up by the stove, looking at me reproachfully.
Don't go giving me the stink eye, I tell her.
and nod toward the closed bedroom door. You know the rules. She puts her snout down between her paws and pretends to sleep, but I know she's still looking at me. I choose cranberry juice while I wait for the coffee. There's OJ, which is my usual morning drink, but I don't want it. Too much like the drink in the dream, I suppose. I have my coffee in the living room with CNN on mute, just reading the crawl at the bottom, which is all a person really needs. Then I turn it off and have a bowl of All Bran. 7:45. I decide that if the day is nice when I take Lady out, I'll skip the cab and walk to work. It's nice, all right. Spring edging into summer, and a shine on everything. Carlo, the doorman, is under the awning, talking on his cell phone.
Yeah, he says. Yeah, I finally got hold of her. She says go ahead, no problem, as long as I'm there. She don't trust nobody, for which I don't blame her. She got a lot of nice things up there. You come when? 3? You can't make it earlier?
He tips me a wave with one white-gloved hand as I walk Lady down to the corner. We've got this down to a science, Lady and I. She does it at pretty much the same place every day, and I'm fast with the poop bag. When I come back, Carlo stoops to give her a pat. Lady waves her tail back and forth most fetchingly, but no treat is forthcoming from Carlo. He knows she's on a diet, or supposed to be.
I finally got hold of Mrs. Warshawski, Carlo tells me.
Mrs. Warshawski is in 5C, but only technically. She's been gone for a couple of months now.
She was in Vienna.
Vienna? Is that so, I say.
She told me to go ahead with the exterminators. She was horrified when I told her. You're the only one on 4, 5, or 6 who hasn't complained. The rest of them...
He shakes his head and makes a whoosh sound. I grew up in a Connecticut mill town. It pretty well wrecked my sinuses. I can smell coffee and Ellie's perfume if she puts it on thick, but that's about all.
In this case, that's probably a blessing. How is Mrs. Franklin, still under the weather?
It'll be a few more days before she's ready to go back to work, but she's a hell of a lot better. She gave me a scare for a while.
Me too. She was going out one day in the rain, naturally.
That's L, I said. Nothing stops her. If she feels like she has to go somewhere, she goes.
And I thought to myself, that's a real graveyard cough.
He raises one gloved hand in a stop gesture.
Not that I really thought. I get it, I said.
It was on the way to becoming a stay-in-the-hospital cough for sure, but I finally got her to see the doctor and now road to recovery.
Good, good.
Then, returning to what's really on his mind,
Mrs. Warshawski was pretty grossed out when I told her. I said we'd probably just find some spoiled food in the fridge, but I know it's worse than that. So does anybody else on those floors with an intact smeller.
He gives a grim little nod.
They're gonna find a dead rat in there, you mark my words. Food stinks, but not like that. Only dead things stink like that. It's a rat, all right, maybe a couple of them. Mrs. W probably put down poison, don't want to admit it.
He bends down to give Lady another pat.
You smell it, don't you, girl? You bet you do.
There's a litter of purple notes around the coffee maker. I take the purple pad they came from to the kitchen table and write another. Ellen. Lady all walked. Coffee ready. If you feel well enough to go out to the park, go. Just not too far. Don't want you to overdo now that you're finally on the mend. Carlo told me again that he smells a rat. I guess so does everyone else in the neighborhood of 5C. Lucky for us that you're plugged up and I'm nasally challenged.
Ha ha.
If you hear people down the hall, it's the exterminators. Carlo will be with them, so don't worry. I'm going to walk to work. Need to think some more about the latest male wonder drug. Wish they'd consulted us before they hung that name on it. Remember, don't overdo. Love you, love you. I jot half a dozen X's just to underline the point, and sign it with a B in a heart. Then I add it to the other notes around the coffee maker. I refill Lady's water dish before I leave. It's 20 blocks or so, and I don't think about the latest male wonder drug. I think about the exterminators who will be coming at 3. Earlier, if they can make it. The dreams have interrupted my sleep cycle, I guess, because I almost fall asleep during the morning meeting in the conference room. But I come around in a hurry when Pete Wendell shows a mock-up poster for the new Petrov Excellent campaign. I've seen it already, on his office computer, while he was fooling with it last week, and looking at it again I know where at least one element of my dream came from. Petrov Excellent Vodka, Aura McLean says. Her wonderful breasts rise and fall in a theatrical sigh. If that name's an example of the new Russian capitalism, it's dead on arrival. The heartiest laughter at this comes from the younger men, who'd like to see Aura's long blonde hair spread on a pillow next to them. No offense to you intended, Pete. Petrov, excellent aside, it's a great leader.
None taken, Pete says with a game smile. We do what we can.
The poster shows a couple toasting each other on a balcony while the sun sinks over a harbor filled with expensive pleasure boats. The cut line beneath reads, Sunset, the perfect time for a vodka sunrise. There's some discussion about the placement of the Petrov bottle, right, left, center, below. And Frank Bernstein suggests that actually adding the recipe might prolong the page view, especially for webvertising and in mags like Playboy and Esquire. I tune out, thinking about the drink sitting on the tray in my airplane dream, until I realize George Slattery is calling on me. I'm able to replay the question, and that's a good thing. You don't ask George to chew his cabbage twice. I'm actually in the same boat as Pete, I say. The client picked the name, I'm just doing what I can. There's some good-natured laughter. There have been many jokes about Vanel Pharmaceuticals' newest drug product. I may have something to show you by Monday, I tell them. I'm not exactly looking at George, but he knows where I'm aiming. By the middle of next week for sure, I want to give Billy a chance to see what he can do. Billy Ederle is our newest hire, and doing his break-in time as my assistant. He doesn't get an invite to the morning meetings yet, but I like him. Everybody at Andrew's Slattery likes him. He's bright, he's eager, and I bet he'll start shaving in a year or two. George considers this. I was really hoping to see a treatment today. Even rough copy. Silence. People study their nails. It's as close to a public rebuke as George ever gets, and maybe I deserve it. This hasn't been my best week, and laying it off on the kid doesn't look so good. Doesn't feel so good either. Okay, George says at last, and you can feel the relief in the room. It's like a light, cool breath of breeze, there and then gone. No one wants to witness a conference room caning on a sunny Friday morning, and I sure don't want to get one. Too much other stuff on my mind. George smells a rat, I think. How's Ellen doing? He asks. Better, I tell him. Thanks for asking. There are a few more presentations, then it's over. Thank God. I'm almost dozing when Billy comes into my office 20 minutes later. Check that. I am dozing. I sit up fast, hoping the kid thinks he caught me deep in thought. He's probably too excited to have noticed either way. In one hand, he's holding a piece of poster board. I think he'd look right at home in Podunk High School, putting up a big notice about the Friday night dance. How was the meeting? He asks. It was okay. Did they bring us up? You know they did. What have you got for me, Billy? He takes a deep breath and turns his poster board around so I can see it. On the left is a prescription bottle for Viagra, either actual size or close enough not to matter. On the right, the power side of the ad, as anyone in advertising will tell you, is a prescription bottle of our stuff, but much bigger. Beneath is the cut line, Potenz, 10 times more effective than Viagra. As Billy looks at me looking at it, his hopeful smile starts to fade. You don't like it. It's not a question of like or don't like. In this business, it never is. It's a question of what works and what doesn't. This doesn't. Now he's looking sulky. If George Slattery saw that look, he'd unload. I won't, although it might feel that way to him because it's my job to teach him. In spite of everything else on my mind, I'll try to do that. Because I love this business. It gets very little respect, but I love it anyway. Also, I can hear Ellen say, You don't let go, babe. Once you get your teeth in something, they stay there. Determination like that can be a little scary. Sit down, Billy. He sits. And wipe that pout off your puss. You look like a kid who just dropped his binky in the toilet. He does his best, which I like about him. Kid's a trier, and if he's going to work in the Andrew Slattery shop, he'd better be. Of course, he also has to be a doer. Good news is I'm not taking it away from you. Mostly because it's not your fault Vanel Pharmaceutical saddled us with a name that sounds like a multivitamin. But we're going to make a silk purse out of this sow's ear. In advertising, that's the main job 7 times out of every 10. Maybe 8. So pay attention. He gets a little grin. Should I take notes? Don't be a smartykins. First, when you're shouting a drug, you never show a prescription bottle. The logo, sure. The pill itself, sometimes, it depends. You know why Pfizer shows the Viagra pill? Because it's blue. Consumers like blue. The shape helps, too. Consumers have a very positive response to the shape of the Viagra tab. But people never like to see the prescription bottle their stuff comes in. Prescription bottles make them think of sickness. Got that? So maybe a little Viagra pill and a big Potenz pill instead of the bottles? He raises his hands, framing an invisible cut line. Potenz. 10 times bigger, 10 times better. Get it? Yeah, Billy, I get it. The FDA will get it, too, and they won't like it. In fact, they could make us take ads with a cut line like that out of circulation, which would cost a bundle, not to mention a very good client. Why? It's almost a bleat. Because it isn't 10 times bigger, and it isn't 10 times better. Viagra, Cialis, Levitra, Potenz, they all have about the same effectiveness when it comes to penis elevation. Do your research, kiddo, and a little refresher course in advertising law wouldn't hurt. Want to say Blowhard's brand muffins are 10 times tastier than Big Mouth's brand muffins? Have at it. Taste is a subjective judgment. What gets your prick hard, though, and for how long? Okay, he says in a small voice. Here's the other half. 10 times more anything is, speaking in erectile dysfunction terms, pretty limp. It went out of vogue around the same time as 2 C's and a K. He looks blank. It's how advertising guys used to refer to their TV ads on the soaps back in the 50s. Stands for 2 cunts in a kitchen. You're joking. Nope. Now here's something I've been playing with. I jot on a pad, and for a moment I think of all those notes scattered around the coffee maker back in good old 5B. Why are they still there? Can't you just tell me? The kid asks from 1,000 miles away. No, because advertising isn't an oral medium. Never trust an ad that's spoken out loud. Write it down. Show it to someone. Show it to your best friend or your wife. Are you okay, Brad? Fine. Why? I don't know. You just look funny for a minute. Just as long as I don't look funny when I present on Monday. Now, what does this say to you? I turn the pad around and show him what I've printed there. Potenz. For men who want to do it the hard way. It's like a dirty joke, he objects. You've got a point, but I printed it in block caps. Imagine it in a soft italic type, or maybe small, in parentheses, like a secret. I add the parens, although they don't work with the caps, but they will. It's a thing I just know because I can see it. Now, playing off that, think of a photo showing a big, burly guy in low-slung jeans that show the top of his underwear, and a sweatshirt with the sleeves cut off, let's say. See him with some grease and dirt on his guns. Guns? His biceps. And he's standing beside a muscle car with the hood up. Now, is it still a dirty joke? I don't know. Neither do I. Not for sure, but my gut tells me it'll pull the plow, but not yet. The cut line still doesn't work, you're right about that, and it's got to because it'll be the basis of the TV and net ads. So, play with it. Make it work. Just remember the key word. Suddenly, just like that, I know where the rest of that damn dream came from. It snaps into place. Brad! The key word is hard, I say, because a man, when something's not working, his prick, his plan, his life, he takes it hard. He doesn't want to give up. He remembers how it was, and he wants it that way again. Yes, I think he sure does. Billy smirks. I wouldn't know. I manage a smile. It feels god-awful heavy, as if there are weights hanging from the corners of my mouth. All at once it's like being in the bad dream again, because there's something close to me I don't want to look at, only this isn't a lucid dream I can back out of. This is lucid reality. After Billy leaves, I go to the can. It's 10 o'clock. Most of the guys in the shop have offloaded their morning coffee and are taking on more in our little break room, so I have the shithouse to myself. I drop my pants so if someone wanders in and happens to look under the door, he won't think I'm weird, but the only business I've come in here to do is thinking. 4 years after coming on board at Andrew Slattery, the Fasprin pain reliever account landed on my desk. I've had some special ones over the years, some breakouts, and that was the first. It happened fast. I opened the sample box, took out the bottle, and the basis of the campaign, what ad men sometimes call the heartwood, came to me in an instant. I ditched around a little, of course, you don't want to make it look too easy, then did some comps. Ellen helped. This was just after we found out she couldn't have babies. It was something to do with a drug she'd been given when she had rheumatic fever as a kid. She was pretty depressed. Helping with the Fasprin comps took her mind off it, and she really threw herself into the thing. Al Peterson was still running things back then, and he was the one I took the comps to. I remember sitting in front of his desk in the sweat seat, with my heart in my mouth as he shuffled slowly through the comps we'd worked up. When he finally put them down and raised his shaggy old head to look at me, the pause seemed to go on for at least an hour. Then he said, "These are good, Bradley. More than good. Terrific. We'll meet with the client tomorrow afternoon. You do the prez." I did the prez, and when the Dugan drug VP saw the picture of the young working woman with the bottle of Fasprin poking out of her rolled-up sleeve, he flipped for it. The campaign brought Fasprin right up there with the big boys, Bayer, Anison, Buffrin, and by the end of the year we were handling the whole Dugan account. Billing, seven figures, not a low seven either. I used the bonus to take Ellen to Nassau for 10 days. We left from Kennedy on a morning that was pelting down rain, and I still remember how she laughed and cried, "Kiss me, beautiful," when the plane broke through the clouds and the cabin filled with sunlight. I did kiss her, and the couple on the other side of the aisle, we were flying in business class, applauded. That was the best. The worst came half an hour later when I turned to her and for a moment thought she was dead. It was the way she was sleeping, with her head cocked over on her shoulder and her mouth open and her hair kind of sticking to the window. She was young. We both were. But the idea of sudden death had a hideous possibility in Ellen's case. "They used to call your condition barren, Mrs. Franklin," the doctor said when he gave us the bad news. "But in this case, your inability to conceive could be a blessing. Pregnancy puts a strain on the heart, and thanks to a disease that was badly treated when you were a child, yours isn't strong. If you did happen to conceive, you'd be in bed for the last 4 months of the pregnancy, and even then the outcome would be dicey." She wasn't pregnant when we left on that trip, and her last checkup had been fine, but the climb up to cruising altitude had been plenty rough, and she didn't look like she was breathing. Then she opened her eyes. I settled back into my aisle seat, letting out a long and shaky breath. She looked at me, puzzled. "What's wrong?" "Nothing. The way you were sleeping, that's all." She wiped at her chin. "Oh, God, did I drool?" "No," I laughed. "But for a minute there, you looked... well, dead." She laughed, too.
"And if I was, you'd ship the body back to New York and I suppose take up with some Bahama mama?"
"No," I said. "I'd take you anyway."
"What?"
"Because I wouldn't accept it. No way would I."
"Well, you'd have to. After a few days, I'd get all smelly."
She was smiling. She thought it was still a game because she hadn't really understood what the doctor was telling her that day. She hadn't, as the saying goes, taken it all the way to the heartwood. And she didn't know how she'd looked, with the sun shining on her winter-pale cheeks and smudged eyelids and slack mouth. But I'd seen, and I'd taken it to the heartwood. She was my heart, and I guard what's there. Nobody takes it away from me.
"You wouldn't," I said. "I'd keep you alive."
"Really?
How?
Necromancy?"
"By refusing to give up and by using an ad man's most valuable asset."
"Which is what, Mr. Fasprin?"
"Imagination." "Now, can we talk about something more pleasant?"
The call I've been expecting comes around 3:30. It's not Carlo. It's Burke Ostro, the building super. He wants to know what time I'm going to be home because the rat everybody's been smelling isn't in 5C. It's in our apartment. Ostro says the exterminators have to leave by 4 to get to another job, but that isn't the important thing. What's important is fixing what's wrong in there, and by the way, Carlo says no one's seen your wife in over a week, just you and the dog. I explain about my deficient sense of smell and Ellen's bronchitis. In her current condition, I say she wouldn't know the drapes were on fire until the smoke detector went off. I'm sure a lady smells it, I tell him, but to a dog, the stench of a decaying rat probably smells like Chanel No. 5.
I get all that, Mr. Franklin, but I still need to get in there to see what's what, and the exterminators will have to be called back. I think you're probably going to be on the hook for their bill, which is apt to be quite high. I could let myself in with a pass key, but I'd really be more comfortable if you were...
Yes, I'd be more comfortable, too, not to mention my wife.
I tried calling her, but she didn't answer the phone.
I can hear suspicion in his voice now. I've explained everything. Advertising men are good at that. But the convincing effect only lasts for 60 seconds or so. That's why you keep hearing the same ads and slogans over and over again. A little dab will do you. Save time, save money. Pepsi for those who think young. I'm loving it. Breakfast of champions. It's like driving a nail, driving it right into the heartwood. She's probably got the phone on mute, plus the medication the doctor gave her makes her sleep quite heavily.
What time will you be home, Mr. Franklin? I can stay until 7. After that, there's only Alfredo.
The disparaging note in his voice suggests I'd be better off dealing with a street weirdo. Never, I think. I'll never be home. In fact, I was never there in the first place. Ellen and I enjoyed the Bahamas so much, we moved to Cable Beach, and I took a job with a little firm in Nassau. I shout cruise ship specials. The ride is the destination. Stereo blowout sales. Don't just hear it better, hear it cheaper. And supermarket openings. Save under the palms. All this New York stuff has just been a lucid dream, one I can escape at any time.
Mr. Franklin, are you there?
Sure. Just thinking. Got one meeting I absolutely can't miss, but why don't you meet me in the apartment around 6?
How about in the lobby, Mr. Franklin? We can go up together.
In other words, I'm not giving you a head start, Mr. Advertising Genius who maybe killed his wife. I think of asking him how he believes I'd beat him to the apartment and get rid of Elle's body, because that is what he's thinking. Maybe murder is not at the very front of his mind, but it's not all the way in back, either. Husband murders wife is very big on the Lifetime channel. Maybe he thinks I'd use the service elevator and stash her body in the box room, or maybe dump it down the incinerator chute. DIY cremation. The lobby is absolutely okie fine, I say. 6. Quarter of, if I can possibly make it. I hang up and head for the elevators. I have to pass the break room to get there. Billy Ederle's leaning in the doorway drinking a Nazi. It's a remarkably lousy soda, but it's all we vend. The company's a client.
Where are you off to?
Home. Ellen called. She's not feeling well.
Don't you want your briefcase?
No. I don't expect to be needing my briefcase for a while. In fact, I may never need it again.
I'm working on the new Potenz direction. I think it's going to be a winner.
I'm sure, I say. And I am. Billy Ederle will soon be moving on up, and good for him. I've got to get a wiggle on.
Sure, I understand.
He's 24 and understands nothing.
Give him my best.
We take on half a dozen interns a year at Andrew Slattery. It's how Billy Ederle got started. Most are terrific, and at first Fred Willett seemed terrific, too. I took him under my wing, and so it became my responsibility to fire him. I guess you'd say that, although interns are never actually hired in the first place. When it turned out he was a klepto who had decided our supply room was his private game preserve. God knows how much stuff he lifted before Maria Ellington caught him loading reams of paper into his briefcase one afternoon. Turned out he was also a bit of a psycho. He went nuclear when I told him he was through. Pete Wendell called security while the kid was yelling at me in the lobby and had him removed forcibly. Apparently old Freddy had a lot more to say, because he started hanging around my building and haranguing me when I came home. He kept his distance, though, and the cops claimed he was just exercising his right to free speech. But it wasn't his mouth I was afraid of. I kept thinking he might have lifted a box cutter, or an X-Acto knife, as well as printer cartridges and about 50 reams of copier paper. That was when I got Carlo to give me a key to the service entrance, and I started going in that way. All that was in the fall of the year, September or October. Young Mr. Willits gave up and took his issues elsewhere when the days turned cold, but Carlo never asked for the return of the key, and I never gave it back. I guess we both forgot. That's why, instead of giving the taxi driver my address, I get him to let me out on the next block. I pay him, adding a generous tip, hey, it's only money, and then walk down the service alley. I have a bad moment when the key doesn't work, but when I jigger it a little, it turns.
The service elevator has brown quilted mover's pads hanging from the walls. Previews of the padded cell they'll put me in, I think. But of course, that's just melodrama. I'll probably have to take a leave of absence from the shop, and what I've done is a lease breaker for sure, but what have I done exactly? For that matter, what have I been doing for the last week? Keeping her alive, I say as the elevator stops at the fifth floor, because I couldn't bear for her to be dead. She isn't dead, I tell myself, just under the weather. It sucks as a cut line, but for the last week it has served me very well. And in the advertising biz, the short term is all that counts. I let myself in. The air is still and warm, but I don't smell anything. So I tell myself anyway. And in the advertising biz, imagination is also what counts. Honey, I'm home, I call. Are you awake? Feeling any better? I guess I forgot to close the bedroom door before I left this morning because Lady slinks out. She's licking her chops. She gives me a guilty glance, then waddles into the living room with her tail tucked way down low. She doesn't look back. Honey? Elle? I go into the bedroom. There's still nothing to be seen of her but the milkweed fluff of her hair and the shape of her body under the quilt. The quilt is slightly rumpled, so I know she's been up, if only to have some coffee, and then gone back to bed again. It was last Friday when I came home and she wasn't breathing, and since then she's been sleeping a lot. I go around to her side and see her hand hanging down. There's not much left of it but bones and strips of flesh. I gaze at this and think there's two ways of seeing it. Look at it one way, and I'll probably have to have my dog, Ellen's dog, really, Lady always loved Ellen best, euthanized. Look at it another way, and you could say Lady got worried and was trying to wake her up. Come on, Ellie, I want to go to the park. Come on, Ellie, let's play with my toys. I tuck the reduced hand under the sheets. That way it won't get cold. Then I wave away some flies. I can't remember ever seeing flies in our apartment before. They probably smelled that dead rat Carla was talking about. You know Billy Edderly, I say? I gave him a slant on that damn Potenz account, and I think he's going to run with it. Nothing from Ellen. You can't be dead, I say. That's unacceptable. Nothing from Ellen. Do you want coffee? I glance at my watch. Something to eat? We've got chicken soup. Just the kind that comes in the pouches, but it's not bad when it's hot. Not bad when it's hot. What a lousy slogan that would be. What do you say, Elle? She says nothing. All right, I say. That's all right. Remember when we went to the Bahamas, hon? When we went snorkeling and you had to quit because you were crying? And when I asked why, you said, because it's all so beautiful. Now I'm the one who's crying. Are you sure you don't want to get up and walk around a little? I'll open the windows and let in some fresh air? Nothing from Ellen. I sigh. I stroke that fluff of hair. All right, I say. Why don't you just sleep for another couple of hours? I'll sit here beside you. And that's exactly what I do.
For Joe Hill. Yeah, it's about baseball, but give it a chance, okay? You don't have to be a sailor to love the novels of Patrick O'Brien, and you don't have to be a jockey, or even a bettor, to love the Dick Francis mysteries. Those stories come alive in the characters and the events. I hope you'll find a similar liveliness here. I got the idea for this tale after watching a postseason playoff game where a bad call resulted in a near riot at Atlanta's Turner Field. Fans showered the field with cups, hats, signs, pennants, and beer bottles. After an umpire was bonked on the head with a pint whiskey bottle, by then empty, of course, the teams were pulled from the field until order could be restored. The TV commentators moaned about poor sportsmanship, as though such ventings of disgust and outrage had not gone on at America's ballparks for 100 years or more. I've loved baseball all my life, and wanted to write about the game as it was in a time when such energetic demurrals, accompanied by declarations of kill the ump and buy him a seeing eye dog, were considered a valid part of the game. A time when baseball was almost as smash mouth as football, when players slid into second base with their cleats up, and collisions at the plate were expected rather than outlawed. Those were days when the reversal of a call based on a TV replay would have been regarded with horror, for the umpire's word was law. I wanted to use the language of those earlier ballplayers to summon up the texture and color of mid-century sporting America. I wanted to see if I could create something that was both mythic and, in a horrible way, sort of funny. I also had a chance to put myself in the story, and I loved that. My first paying gig as a writer was as a sports reporter for the Lisbon Enterprise, after all. My sons call that sort of thing metafiction. I just think of it as fun, and I hope that's what this story is. Good old-fashioned fun, with the last line cribbed from a great movie called The Wild Bunch. But watch out for the blade, constant reader. It is a Stephen King story, after all.
Blockade Billy, read by Craig Wasson.
William Blakely? Oh, my God, you mean Blockade Billy. Nobody's asked me about him in years. Of course, no one asked me much of anything in here, except if I'd like to sign up for Polka Night at the KFP Hall downtown, or something called Virtual Bowling. That's right here, in the common room. My advice to you, Mr. King, you didn't ask for it, but I'll give it to you, is don't get old. And if you do, don't let your relatives put you in a zombie hotel like this one. It's a funny thing, getting old. When you're young, people always want to listen to your stories, especially if you were in pro baseball. But when you're young, you don't have time to tell them. Now I've got all the time in the world, and it seems like nobody cares about those old days. But I still like to think about them. So sure, I'll tell you about Billy Blakely. Awful story, of course, but those are the ones that last the longest. Baseball was different in those days. You have to remember that Blockade Billy played for the Titans only 10 years after Jackie Robinson broke the color barrier, and the Titans are long gone. I don't suppose New Jersey will ever have another major league team, not with two powerhouse franchises just across the river in New York. But it was a big deal then. We were a big deal, and we played our games in a different world. The rules were the same, those don't change. And the little rituals were pretty similar, too. Oh, nobody would have been allowed to wear their cap cocked to the side or curve the brim, and your hair had to be neat and short, the way these chuckleheads wear it now, my God. But some players still crossed themselves before they stepped into the box or drew in the dirt with the heads of their bats before taking up the stance or jumped over the baseline when they were running out to take their positions. Nobody wanted to step on the baseline. It was considered the worst luck to do that. The game was local, okay? TV had started to come in, but only on the weekends. We had a good market because the games were on WNJ, and everyone in New York could watch. Some of those broadcasts were pretty comical. Compared to the way they do today's games, it was all amateur night in Dixie. Radio was better, more professional, but of course that was local too. No satellite broadcasts, because there were no satellites. The Russians sent the first one up during the Yanks-Braves World Series that year. As I remember, it happened on an off day, but I could be wrong about that. What I remember is that the Titans were out of it early that year. We contended for a while partly thanks to Blockade Billy, but you know how that turned out. It's why you came, right? But here's what I'm getting at. Because the game was smaller on the national stage, the players weren't such a big deal. I'm not saying there weren't stars, guys like Aaron, Burdett, Williams, Kaline, and of course the Mick. But most weren't as well known coast to coast as players like Alex Rodriguez and Barry Bonds. A couple of bushers, if you ask me. And most of the other guys? I can tell you in two words, working stiffs. The average salary back then was 15 grand, less than a first-year high school teacher makes today. Working stiffs. Get it? Just like George Will said in that book of his, only he talked about that like it was a good thing. I'm not so sure it was if you were a 30-year-old shortstop with a wife and three kids and maybe another 7 years to go before retirement. 10, if you were lucky and didn't get hurt. Carl Ferrillo ended up installing elevators in the World Trade Center and moonlighting as a night watchman. Did you know that? You did? Do you think that guy Will knew it? Or just forgot to mention it? The deal was this. If you had the skills and could do the job even with a hangover, you got to play. If you couldn't, you got tossed on the scrap heap. It was that simple and as brutal. Which brings me to our catching situation that spring. We were in good shape during camp, which for the Titans was in Sarasota. Our starting catcher was Johnny Goodkind. Maybe you don't remember him. If you do, it's probably because of the way he ended up. He had 4 good years, batted over 300, put the gear on almost every game. He knew how to handle the pitchers, didn't take any guff. The kids didn't dare shake him off. He hit damn near 350 that spring, with maybe a dozen ding-dongs. One as deep and as far as any I ever saw at Ed Smith Stadium, where the ball didn't carry well. Put out the windshield in some reporter's Chevrolet. But he was also a big drinker. And 2 days before the team was supposed to head north and open at home, he ran over a woman on Pineapple Street and killed her just as dead as a dormouse. Or doornail, whatever the saying is. And then the damn fool tried to run. But there was a county sheriff's cruiser parked on the corner of Orange, and the deputies inside saw the whole thing. Wasn't much doubt about Johnny's state, either. When they pulled him out of his car, he smelled like a brewery and could hardly stand. One of the deputies bent down to put the cuffs on him, and Johnny threw up on the back of the guy's head. Johnny Goodkind's career in baseball was over before the puke dried. Even the Babe couldn't have stayed in the game after running over a housewife out doing her morning shop around. His backup was a guy named Frank Faraday. Not bad behind the plate, but a banjo hitter at best. Went about 150, no bulk, which put him at risk. The game was played hard in those days, Mr. King, with plenty of fuck you. But Faraday was what we had. I remember DePunno saying he wouldn't last long, but not even Jersey Joe had an idea how short a time it was going to be. Faraday was behind the plate when we played our last exhibition game that year. Against the Reds, it was. There was a squeeze play put on. Don Hoke at the plate, some big Hulk. I think it was Ted Klazuski on third. Hoke punches the ball right at Jerry Rugg, who was pitching for us that day. Big Clue breaks for the plate, all 270 Pollock pounds of him, and there's Faraday, just about as skinny as a flavor straw, standing with 1 foot on the old Deshola. You knew it was going to end bad. Rugg throws to Faraday. Faraday turns to put the tag on. I couldn't look. Faraday hung onto the ball and got the out. I'll give him that. Only it was a spring training out. As important in the great scheme of things as a low fart and a high wind. And that was the end of his baseball career. One broken arm, one broken leg, a concussion. That was the score. I don't know what became of him. Wound up washing windshields for tips at an Esso station in Tucum, Cary, for all I know. He wouldn't be the only one. But here's the point. We lost both our catchers in the space of 48 hours and had to go north with nobody to put behind the plate except for Gansey Burgess, who converted from catcher to pitcher in the early 50s. He was 39 years old that season and only good for middle relief. But he was a knuckleballer and as crafty as Satan, so no way was Joe DiPanna going to risk those old bones behind the plate. He said he'd put me back there first. I knew he was joking. I was just an old third base coach with so many groin pulls, my balls were practically banging on my knees. But the idea still made me shiver. What Joe did was call the front office in Newark and say, I need a guy who can catch Hank Master's fastball and Danny Dew's curve without falling on his keister. I don't care if he plays for Testicle Tire and Tremont. Just make sure he's got a mitt and have him at the swamp in time for the national anthem. Then get to work finding me a real catcher. If you want to have any chance at all of contending this season, that is. Then he hung up and lit what was probably his 80th cigarette of the day. Ah, oh, for the life of a manager, huh? One catcher facing manslaughter charges. Another in the hospital wrapped in so many bandages he looked like Boris Karloff in The Mummy. A pitching staff either not old enough to shave or about ready for the sociable security. God knows who about to put on the gear and squat behind the plate on opening day. We flew north that year instead of riding the rails, but it still felt like a train wreck. Meanwhile, Kerwin McCaslin, who was the Titans' GM, got on the phone and found us a catcher to start the season with. William Blakely, soon to be known as Blockade Billy. I can't remember now if he came from double or triple A, but you could look it up on your computer, I guess, because I do know the name of the team he came from. The Davenport Cornhuskers. A few players came up from there during my 7 years with the Titans, and the regulars would always ask how things were down there playing for the Cornholers. Or sometimes they'd call them the Cocksuckers. Baseball humor is not what you'd call sophisticated. We opened against the Red Sox that year, middle of April. Baseball started later back then, played a saner schedule. I got to the park early that day, before God got out of bed, actually, and there was a young man sitting on the bumper of an old Ford truck in the player's lot. Iowa license plate dangling on chicken wire from the back bumper. Nick, the guard, let him in when the kid showed him his letter from the front office and his driver's license. You must be Bill Blakely, I said, shaking his hand. Good to know you.
Good to know you, too, he said. I brought my gear, but it's pretty beat up.
Oh, I think we can take care of you there, partner, I said, letting go of his hand. He had a Band-Aid wrapped around his second finger, just below the middle knuckle. Cut yourself shaven? I asked, pointing to it.
Yeah, cut myself shaven, he says.
I couldn't tell if that was his way of showing he got my little joke or if he was so worried about fucking up he thought he ought to agree with everything anyone said. At least to begin with. Later on, I realized it was neither of those things. He just had a habit of echoing back what you said to him. I got used to it, even sort of got to like it.
Are you the manager? He asked. Mr. DiPanna?
No, I said. I'm George Grantham. Granny to you. I coach third base. I'm also the equipment manager. Which was the truth. I did both jobs. Told you the game was smaller then. I'll get you fixed up, don't worry, all new gear.
All new gear, says he,
except for the glove. I have to have Billy's old glove, you know. Billy Jr. and me's been the miles. Well, that's fine with me. And we went on into what the sports writers used to call Old Swampy in those days. I hesitated over giving him 19, because it was poor old Faraday's number, but the uniform fit him without looking like pajamas, so I did. While he was dressing, I said, ain't you tired? You must have driven almost nonstop. Didn't they send you some cash to take a plane?
I ain't tired, he said. They might have sent me some cash to take a plane, but I didn't see it. Could we go look at the field?
I said we could, and led him down the runway and up through the dugout. He walked down to home plate outside the foul line in Faraday's uniform, the blue 19 gleaming in the morning sun. It wasn't but 8 o'clock, the groundskeepers just starting what would be a long day's work.
I wish I could tell you how it felt to see him taking that walk, Mr. King. But words are your thing, not mine. All I know is that back to, he looked more like Faraday than ever. He was 10 years younger, of course, but age doesn't show much from the back, except sometimes in a man's walk. Plus, he was slim like Faraday, and slim's the way you want your shortstop and second baseman to look, not your catcher. Catchers should be built like fireplugs, the way Johnny Goodkind was. This one looked like a bunch of broken ribs waiting to happen. He had a firmer build than Frank Faraday, though, broader butt and thicker thighs. He was skinny from the waist up, but looking at him ass-end going away, I remember thinking he looked like what he probably was, an Iowa plowboy on vacation in scenic Newark. He went to the plate and turned around to look out to dead center. He had dark hair, and a lock of it had fallen on his forehead. He brushed it away and just stood there, taking it all in, the silent, empty stands where over 50,000 people would be sitting that afternoon, the bunting already hung on the railings and fluttering in the little morning breeze, the foul poles painted fresh jersey blue, the groundskeepers just starting to water. It was an awesome sight, I always thought, and I could imagine what was going through the kid's mind. Him that had probably been home milking the cows just a week ago and waiting for the cornholers to start playing in mid-May. I thought, poor kid's finally getting the picture. When he looks over here, I'll see the panic in his eyes. I may have to tie him down in the locker room to keep him from jumping in that old truck of his and hightailing it back to God's country. But when he looked at me, there was no panic in his eyes, no fear, not even nervousness, which I would have said every player feels on opening day. No, he looked perfectly cool standing there behind the plate in his Levi's and light poplin jacket. "Yep," he says, like a man confirming something he was pretty sure of in the first place. "Billy can hit here." "Good for him," I tells him. It's all I can think of to say. "Good," he says back. Then, I swear, he says, "Do you think those guys need help with them hoses?" I laughed. There was something strange about him, something off, something that made folks nervous. But that something made people take to him, too. Kind of sweet. Something that made you want to like him, in spite of feeling he wasn't exactly right in the top story. Joe felt it right away. Some of the players did, too, but that didn't stop them from liking him. I don't know. It was like when you talked to him, what came back was the sound of your own voice, like an echo in a cave. "Billy," I said, "groundskeeping ain't your job. Bill's job is to put on the gear and catch Danny Deuce this afternoon." "Danny Dew," he said. "That's right. 20-6 last year. Should have won the Cy Young, didn't?" "He's still got a red ass over that. And remember this. If he shakes you off, don't you dare flash the same sign again. Not unless you want your pecker and asshole to change places after the game, that is. Danny Dew is 4 games from 200 wins. And he's going to be mean as hell until he gets there." "Until he gets there," nodding his head. "That's right. If he shakes me off, flash something different." "Yes." "Does he have a changeup?" "Do you have 2 legs? The Dew's won 196 games. You don't do that without a changeup." "Not without a changeup," he says. "Okay. And don't get hurt out there. Until the front office can make a deal, you're what we got." "I'm it," he says. "Gotcha." I hope so. Other players were coming in by then, and I had about 1,000 things to do. Later on, I saw the kid in Jersey Joe's office, signing whatever needed to be signed with Kerwin McCaslin hanging over him like a vulture over roadkill, pointing out all the right places. Poor kid. Probably 6 hours worth of sleep in the last 60, and he was in there signing 5 years of his life away. Later, I saw him with Deuson, going over the Boston lineup. The dude was doing all the talking, and the kid was doing all the listening. Didn't even ask a question, so far as I saw, which was good. If the kid had opened his head, Danny probably would have bit it off. About an hour before the game, I went into Joe's office to look at the lineup card. He had the kid batting eighth, which was no shock. Over our heads, the murmuring had started, and you could hear the rumble of feet on the boards. Opening day crowds always pile in early. Listening to it started the butterflies in my gut, like always, and I could see Jersey Joe felt the same. His ashtray was already overflowing. "He's not big like I hoped he'd be," he said, tapping Blakely's name on the lineup card. "God help us if he gets cleaned out."
"McCaslin hasn't found anyone else?"
"Maybe. He talked to Hubie Ratner's wife, but Hubie's on a fishing trip somewhere in rectal temperature Michigan. Out of touch until next week."
"Cap, Hubie Ratner's 43 if he's a day."
"Beggars can't be choosers. And be straight with me. How long do you think that kid's going to last in the bigs?"
"Oh, he's probably just a cup of coffee," I says.
"But he's got something Faraday didn't." "And what might that be?"
"Don't know, but if you'd seen him standing behind the plate and looking out into center, you might feel better about him. It was like he was thinking, this ain't the big deal I thought it would be."
"He'll find out how big a deal it is the first time Ike DeLock throws one at his nose," Joe said, and lit a cigarette. He took a drag and started hacking. I gotta quit these luckies. Not a cough in a carload, my ass. I'll bet you 20 goddamn bucks that kid lets Danny Dew's first curve go right through his wickets. Then Danny'll be all upset. You know how he gets when someone fucks up his train ride, and Boston'll be off to the races."
"Ain't you just the cheeriest cheerio," I says. He stuck out his hand.
"Bet."
And because I knew he was trying to take the curse off it, I shook his hand. That was 20 I won, because the legend of Blockade Billy started that very day. You couldn't say he called a good game, because he didn't call it. The dude did that. But the first pitch to Frank Malzone was a curve, and the kid caught it just fine. Not only that, though, it was a cunt's hair outside, and I never saw a catcher pull one back so fast, not even Yogi. Ump called strike one, and it was off to the races, at least until Williams hit a solo shot in the fifth. We got that back in the sixth when Ben Vincent put one out. Then in the seventh, we've got a runner on second. I think it was Barbarino, with two outs and the new kid at the plate. It was his third at bat. First time, he struck out looking. The second time, swinging. DeLock fooled him bad that time, made him look silly, and he heard the only boos he ever got while he was wearing a Titans uniform. He steps in, and I looked over at Joe. Seen him sitting way down by the lineup car, just looking at the floor and shaking his head. Even if the kid worked a walk, the dude was up next. And the dude couldn't hit a slow-pitch softball with a tennis racket. As a hitter, that guy was fucking terrible. I won't drag out the suspense. This ain't no kid's sports novel. Although, whoever said life sometimes imitates art was right. And it did that day. Count went to 3-2. Then DeLock threw the sinker that fooled the kid so bad the first time. And damn if the kid didn't suck for it again, except Ike DeLock turned out to be the sucker that time. Kid golfed it right off his shoe tops, the way Ellie Howard used to do, and shot it into the gap. I waved the runner in, and we had the lead back, 2-1. Everybody in the joint was on their feet, screaming their throats out, but the kid didn't even seem to hear it. Just stood there on second, dusting off the seat of his pants. He didn't stay there long because the dew went down on three pitches, then threw his bat like he always did when he got struck out. So maybe it's a sports novel after all, like the kind you probably read in junior high school study hall. Top of the ninth, and the dude's looking at the top of the lineup, strikes out Malzone,
and a quarter of the crowd's on their feet. Strikes out Klaus, and half the crowd's on their feet. Then comes Williams, old Teddy Ballgame. The Duke gets him on the hip, 0-2, then weakens and walks him. The kid starts out to the mound, and Dew waves him back. Just squat and do your job, sonny.